All right, Judges chapter 9. And sorry, if you're taking the CDs last week, someone didn't work the recorder right, so it wasn't recorded. So
and you'll admit it.
Okay. We have gone through the 21st verse of chapter 9. We have been introduced after Gideon has passed. We've been introduced last week to Gideon, one of Gideon's 70 sons. A son by one of Gideon's concubine. Certainly not well received by the first. I'm not trying to be crude or anything. I just want you to understand the mentality. This son would not have been well received by the first tier of sons, not the son of the primary wife and a concubine son. When Gideon dies and everything is sort of up in the air, Abimelech takes the initiative, as we read in the scripture, and goes back to his hometown where his mother, who's Gideon's concubine, lives, and gathers his relatives there and says, you know what, I need you to help me do this. And pretty much what he says to him is, if you'll help me do this, it will be beneficial not only to me but to you, since if I end up being king, you're my family. And it talks about that they raise money and he buys up a bunch of mercenaries and he takes them back and he kills all of his brothers on one stone. But he misses one, which is the youngest of the brothers, and his name is Jotham. And so after he does this, we have, starting in verse 7, you have Jotham standing up on Mount Gerizim and keeping a fair distance, and begins to yell down to Abimelech and the men. And he actually calls down a curse on both Shechem, which is a community, and on Abimelech for what they have done. So, pretty much says, may Shechem kill Abimelech and may Abimelech destroy Shechem, type thing. So, verse 22 is where we are this evening. So it says, after Abimelech had reigned over Israel for 3 years, God sent a spirit of ill will between Abimelech and the men of Shechem, and the men of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech. So there is this, there's contention. And the recorder of Judges says that God sent this. And notice it's been 3 years. So, when you have any kind of alliances based upon being devious and murder and stuff like that, it's not going to stand for very long. Okay, so, but you'll see that this rises up here. It says in verse 24 that the crime done to the 70 sons of Jerubbaal might be settled and their blood be laid on Abimelech, their brother, who killed them, and on the men of Shechem who aided him in killing his brothers. So God is pretty much bringing to pass what Jotham said, that both Abimelech and Shechem would pay for the murder of the sons of Gideon. Okay, and God, according to the author here, God is involved in this. Okay, verse 25, and the men of Shechem set men in ambush against him on the tops of the hills, and they robbed all who passed by along the way, and it was told Abimelech. All right, and basically that's where we ended last week. So now verse 26. Now Gaal the son of Ebed came with his brothers and went over to Shechem. And the men of Shechem put their confidence in him. So what do we have here? We have a vacuum. Nature does not allow for a vacuum. Abimelech is still alive, but he's not recognized as a leader to the men of Shechem any longer. So someone's going to step up. It always happens that way. Think about life. It always happens that way. If there's a vacancy when it comes to a position, someone's going to step up and step into that vacancy. And that's what's happening here. So we have Gaal, the son of Ebed, who came with his brothers. They feel that. And so it says, so they went out in the fields and gathered grapes from the vineyards and trod them and made merry and went into the house of their God and ate and drank and cursed Abimelech. So they're having him for dinner and for lunch and for breakfast and for dessert. And by the way, the nature of human beings, once things start to turn sour, it's almost like, well, I always think about it like this. You start a pebble at the top of the hill and it starts rolling. If the hill's long enough, before long you have another rock is kicked loose and several rocks kicked loose. Before long you have an avalanche. And someone's crushed at the bottom. And that's the way that dissension happens. I would say in families it happens that way, in churches it happens that way, in governments it happens that way. If someone doesn't stop it. But left to its own, what's the, James uses the analogy, he says the tongue is a fire and who can quench it? A little bitty flame can actually start a whole forest to burning. So that's the picture that he used. You know, if you think it always begins, think about it, with that little match. One little stick with a little bit of, what do they put on the end of those things? Sulfur or whatever? Huh? Okay. And if I, and a little bitty flame like that, but if it gets out of control, it can burn out a whole forest. And that's the way he says the tongue is. Huh?
And the rudder of the ship.
And yeah, he talks about the rudder of the ship or the bit in a horse's mouth. You know, all those, it always starts with something small. It's not, I would almost say when you're talking about overthrowing leadership and stuff like that, it very rarely happens where one person steps up out of nowhere and says, I'm taking charge. Because the people won't say, well, who are you to step in here trying to take charge? It usually is very insidious. It usually is someone who starts this over here and this over here. And before long, people are agreeing with everybody, and that's the picture that we got here. So these people are, they found a place of contention. Now you have these people who are going to take advantage of that to gain what they want out of it. Doug?
Isn't that the way society is and has always been? For some reason, we want to elevate people into a position, whether it's politics or Hollywood, or we want to elevate them into position, and then we can't wait until we take a pot shot at them.
Oh, yeah.
So it always starts with society, and then someone steps in and starts that insidious fact. But what makes us do that? Why do we elevate people up and then want to knock them down?
I don't know.
Well,
that explains it.
Played it up for me.
I really think that somehow, there's something within humanity that it makes us feel like we're something if we can do that. I mean, it doesn't sound right, but if we can exalt somebody or lift them up, like you say, and then we feel like we have the power to knock them down. For some reason, I don't know. That's a very interesting thought.
I wonder if that's why Jesus is not exalted by the rest of the world, because they can't knock him down.
If you think about it, with all the miracles that he did and everything that Jesus did in the 3 years, he stayed under the radar the whole time. There was a couple times when they tried to promote him, and he said, "Nope, it's not going to happen." You know. And even when he stood before the kings, he didn't try to exalt himself. So, wow.
I think it's jealousy. The Bible says jealousy is the rage of man.
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But it's amazing because we have a tendency to be cowards to where we would never put ourselves up there. But we, as Doug said, we elevate someone else. And then it's kind of like projecting what's inside you onto that person, and that's what you start to hatch away.
And the coward thing is right. It's usually done behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of the Ides of March right there, and I'm thinking about, Brutus and the Caesar and what he said, "You too, Brutus, or et tu," or whatever, And he actually stabs him in the back. Mm-hmm. So we get the stabbing in the back thing. All right. Okay. Verse 28, then Gaal the son of Ebed said, "Who is Abimelech, and who is Shechem, that we should serve him? Is he not the son of Jerubbaal, and is not Zebu his officer? Serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem, but why should we serve him?" So what's he doing here?
Oh, he's
playing the old ethnic card.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is.
He is. No other way to put it.
And not only that, but playing the ethnic card in such a way that the group that he's with, he's really sly here. I mean, he tries to. He ends up his little tirade, I would say, there by promoting the men that he's with. To, you know, he starts out by this comparison, and you know, it's like one of those things when you start, well, who's Shechem and who is Abimelech, and at that point a guy could go either way, could they not? And then what's he do? He turns it very quickly, and he tries to, well, who is this guy to tell us anything? You know, and he does. I exactly right. He's not one of us. He's not like us. Why should we be listening to him? He'll not be our king, type of thing. So, verse 29, if only this people were under my hand, then I would remove Abimelech. So he said to Abimelech, increase your army and come out. So now we have someone promising a whole bunch, right?
Yep.
So. Yeah. Complainers ought to always be careful because they may get exactly what they're complaining about.
Absolutely.
And may not like what they get when they get it.
Like that boomerang.
Yeah. If you think about that. Yeah. We don't want Abimelech, you know. Abimelech is bad enough, but this guy is a piece of work coming up here. All right, so verse 30, when Zebul, the ruler of the city, heard the words of Gaal, the son of Ebed, his anger was aroused, and he sent messengers to Abimelech secretly, saying, take note, Gaal, the son of Ebed, and his brothers have come to Shechem, and here they are fortifying the city against you. So Shechem was pretty much his seat of power, right? His hometown, his seat of power. But again, the men of Shechem have turned against him. So you almost get the picture that he's in a little bit of exile at this point. Wouldn't you agree? That Abimelech is in exile from Shechem, but he still has men that are around there. Okay? So, verse 32. Now therefore, get up by night, you and the people who are with you, and lie in wait in the field. So he's telling them to do an ambush. Right? And it shall be, as soon as the sun is up in the morning, that you shall rise early and rush upon the city. And as soon as he and the people who are with him come out against you, you may do to them as you find the opportunity. So it's an ambush. Lay out there at night when the sun comes up, first thing in the morning, when people are really not as aware as they ought to be about things, that's a good time for an ambush. First light, good time for an ambush. Okay? So it says, so Abimelech and all the people who were with him rose by night and laid in wait against Shechem in four companies. When Gaal the son of Ebed went out and stood in the entrance of the city gate, Abimelech and the people who were with him rose from lying in wait, or from the ambush. Some translations say from the ambush. And when Gaal saw the people, he said to Zebul, look, people are coming down from the mountaintops. But Zebul said to him, you see shadows of the mountains as if they were men. So what's he saying? You're not quite awake yet. You're not, you know, first light. You're still half asleep. You're not seeing what you think you're seeing. So Gaal spoke again and said, see, people are coming down from the center of the land, and another company is coming from the diviner's tabernacle tree. Then Zebul said to him, where indeed is your mouth now? Oh, God. I like that. I need to write that one down. So when you know you deal with somebody who shoots off at the mouth, you know, it's like, where indeed is your mouth now, with which you said, who is Abimelech that we should serve that we should serve him? In other words, you're in big trouble. You know it now. So keep talking. You know, keep boasting. Keep talking. Won't you say it up loud now? You said it in the tavern. You said it around all the people that were mad at Abimelech. Now, won't you say it now? Because I think Abimelech can hear your voice. Do you see what's playing here? You ever done that with somebody? And I know none of you would ever sit in a room somewhere and just talk about somebody. Or listen to, maybe you're not talking, but listen to someone talk about someone else. And then all of a sudden the person that someone is talking about walks in the room. You know what I'm talking about? And it gets real quiet. You've never seen that. Felicia. Okay.
Talking about you.
Oh, you know.
And you walk in the room and all of a sudden everyone's
quiet. And when everybody's quiet, you know.
Yeah,
well,
you know, you yourself in person.
You know, but that. But wouldn't it be something? Wouldn't it be something if you're sitting there listening to this person just raking somebody over the coals, and you just about had enough of it, and the person walks in, and everybody gets real quiet, and then you say, "Hey, where's your mouth now? He's standing right here."
Speak up.
You were able to talk. Some of the things that I've kind of thought, I think I've learned over the years is the reality is if you're not willing to say it to somebody, then you ought not to say it at all. The other thing that I think that is an important thing, especially when you deal with churches and stuff, when people get upset with churches, which happen all the time, I know that's hard to believe, but it happens all the time, and maybe they feel they need to move on to another church, one of the things I try to counsel them, I said, if I'm not the one they're mad at and they'll listen to me, I always say, don't say something on the way, and I've said this to pastors who've got burned, or I say to them, don't say something on the way out the door that you wouldn't say staying and trying to make it right.
That's right.
I mean, it's so easy to take a pot shot on the way out the door. Mm-hmm. You know, everything that's wrong with the church, everything's wrong with everything. And you may believe everything's wrong, but it does no good except cause dissension for you to say it on the way out the door. Now, if you want to say it and stay, that's a whole nother matter. That's a whole nother matter. But it's a coward who says it on the way out the door and then leaves broken lives behind.
Yeah,
so.
The very history of this church from the beginning has gone through those very same things. There have been people who have left gracefully and eventually came back gracefully.
Yeah.
There were people who left bad-mouthing and then were put in a position where they felt so bad they didn't have the guts and courage to come back.
Yeah.
It kept them away.
Yeah.
I would guess, I know this is the only church that you've been a part of. I would guess that's true of almost all churches. That is a scenario. If we talked about the nature of people to do what we're talking about here. I think that's the nature of every church this is my fourth church that I've pastored, and it's been in every one of them that way.
So that's sad, because I've always felt like if you have something to say, you say it. And
I'll
say it
instead,
because the whole idea is getting solved.
That's why we love you. It's right out front.
Well, I just think that's an important thing. It is a coward who use words to destroy and then leave, so because you don't have to deal with what you left behind. You know, yet it happens far too often. And I just love how this guy says to him, "Where's your mouth at now?" You know. I got to remember that phrase. I'm going to work on that one some.
Yeah.
But, verse 39 says, "So Gaal went out, leading the men of Shechem, and fought with Abimelech. And Abimelech chased him, and he fled from him, and many fell wounded, even to the entrance of the gate. Then Abimelech dwelt with Arumah and Zebul, drove out Gaal and his brothers so that they would not dwell in Shechem." So there's enough people inside the city still under Zebul's leadership that when Gaal tried to come back in the city, he forced them back out. And that's pretty much a death thing. You know, we're going to put you back right back out there in the battle. You're not going to hide here. The city's not going to protect you. So verse 40 says, "And Abimelech chased him, and he fled from him, and many fell wounded, even to the entrance of the gate." Now go down to verse 42. "And it came about on the next day that the people went out into the field, and they told Abimelech. So he took his people, divided them into three companies, and laid in wait in the field. And he looked, and there were the people coming out of the city, and he rose against them and attacked them. Then Abimelech and the company that was with him rushed forward and stood at the gate of the city. Another two companies rushed upon all those who were in the field and killed them." So what's he done? He's flanked them. Right? That's what I read. He's outflanked them where they cannot come, even go back to the city. And so when they run to the field away from the city, what happens? Well, there's two other companies out there that are waiting for them out there.
These are not fighters.
Who?
The people.
The people, no.
They went in the field to harvest. They're farmers. They figured
the
danger's over and they went out. Yeah.
So he's punishing, not he's already punished Gaul, but now he's going to punish the people for what they've done. Because what they've done, and again, I'm not saying he's justified, I'm just saying, but what they've done has made it possible for a person like Gaul and his men to do what they did. So, by the way, is this at the hand of God, or is it at the hand of Abimelech? I would say the answer is yes. It's at both. Because it can't happen unless God, and that's what the writer tells us, that God has moved this spirit of dissension among them, and the result now is that what Jotham said would happen is about to happen. That's the destruction of Shechem, and ultimately the destruction of Abimelech.
Isn't that kind of similar to the plan that Gideon did on that large group?
Yeah. It's amazing how many times it repeats itself, this type of thing. All right, so. Verse 45. So Abimelech fought against the city all that day. He took the city and killed the people who were in it, and he demolished the city, and he sowed it with salt. So what's he done? He's completely destroyed this city that has rejected, which you got to believe is a lot of his own people. The other thing that he did, he not only sacked the city, in other words, killed all the people in it, he has destroyed the city, and not only destroyed the city, but he has sowed it with salt.
Yeah, what was that?
Well, that was an ancient way to say that may nothing else ever grow here. It's a way to poison the ground, so that nothing would grow there and nothing would be there. It would certainly have more of an effect, this sowing of salt, on the fields that they were talking about, rather than like the city streets or anything like that. Any other comments on that? All right, verse 46. Now, when all the men of the tower of Shechem had heard that, they entered the stronghold of the temple of the god Bereth, and it was told Abimelech that all the men of the tower of Shechem were gathered together. Then Abimelech went up to Mount Zalman, and he and the people who were with him. And Abimelech took an axe in his hand and cut down a bough from the trees and took it and laid it on his shoulder. And he said to the people who were with him, "What you have seen me do, make haste and do what I have done." So each of the people likewise cut his own bough and followed Abimelech, put them against the stronghold, and set the stronghold on fire above them, so that all the people of the Tower of Shechem died, about 1,000 men and women. Wow.
That's pretty brutal.
It is brutal. Completely brutal.
It's disgusting.
But, I mean, if you just think about it, that's the brutality of the people at this time is just—it's just hard for us to fathom.
Yeah.
But he burned them alive, is what he did,
yeah.
And that must have been quite a tower or a stronghold, because you had 1,000 men and women in there.
And children.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. All right, so it says, verse 50, then Abimelech went to the Bez, and he encamped against the Bez and took it. So the word encamp, actually, some translators probably said besieged or attacked. Okay. But there was a strong tower in the city, and all the men and women and all the people of the city fled there and shut themselves in. Then they went up to the tower, to the top of the tower. So this you got to be thinking, this almost feels like a repeat of what just happened, right? And so I'm sure Abimelech says, "Well, you know, this is—I don't even have to think of a of a real game plan on this one. This already proved how we can do this. So it says, verse 52, so Abimelech came as far as the tower and fought against it and drew near the door of the tower to burn it with fire. So the fire thing again. But a certain woman dropped an upper millstone on Abimelech's head and crushed his skull. And verse 54 just amazes me. You talk about the last ounce of pride that a guy can have. And here's what then he quickly called to the young man, his armor bearer, and said to him, "Draw your sword and kill me, lest man say a woman killed me." So the young man thrust him through, and he died. And when the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, they departed, every man to his own place. Okay, the fight's over. Time to go. You know,
pick up sticks and I don't get it.
One of the things that it does is maybe it shows us something that many times we when you think about it in a contemporary sense, we're not sieging cities like this and stuff. But sometimes it's issues. Sometimes it's issues or direction. And I like to make a little spiritual analogy here and stuff, where you may have a leader, let's say in a church, let's do it from a church perspective, a pastor who feels a certain direction that the Lord's leading. The big question becomes is it the pastor's vision or is it the church's vision? And do those two gel together? Because I really think when the two gel together, that's when things really begin to happen. One of the evidences that it was only the pastor's vision is if the Lord chooses to remove the pastor and the people just go, you know, their own way, just like these guys, maybe that's an indicator that many people were involved just because they had a leader to lead them. And there was they didn't really buy into the vision. It wasn't their vision. I don't know. Just some thoughts there. What do y'all think? There's not a big group in here, so you can say what you think. So.
You're right. I think that the people and the man have to have the same vision for it to work. If they don't have the same vision, then you're going to have this splinter. You're going to have this. As soon as something happens to one party or an individual, you're going to have this breakup, this split.
Mm-hmm. I think it also helps ought to help us evaluate things, because people will follow a leader. I mean, that's the way we are. We'll follow a leader, and sometimes people will do that without ever evaluating why they're following the leader. We're following the leader because he's the leader, instead of a shared vision, a desire for God to do something. So, you know. We always ask questions like, you know, how could a whole nation follow a guy like Hitler or Jim Jones down there? And I mean, we can go right on down the list of these people who we consider to be horrible people, but the reality is they were leaders. They were gifted to be leaders. They were evil, but they had the gift to be leaders, and people seemed to follow them blindly. So it's an interesting phenomenon.
Well, we know that's not going to end. Right to the end time.
Right. The Antichrist
is
going
to take place on a humongous scale.
Yeah, worldwide.
Yeah.
Okay. Verse 56. Thus God repaid the wickedness of Abimelech, which he had done to his fathers by killing his 70 his father by killing his 70 brothers. So, people say, well, God did not punish him or judge him directly. Well, but the Bible says that he was judged or he was punished for what he had did. And all the evil of the men of Shechem, God returned on their own heads, and on them came the curse of Jotham the son of Jerubbaal. So exactly what Jotham said happened. Both Shechem and Abimelech died or were destroyed. And both of them, notice it, completely destroyed. Certainly when you talk about Abimelech, you're talking about one man. But now look at Shechem. There is no Shechem. When everything's said and done, you have a complete annihilation of the whole community. And even up until including the spreading of the salt to try to poison the ground. So nothing can grow there.
So the curse that Jotham put out, you have to be led to believe that God empowered him with those words.
Yeah, so you move into, was it a prophetic utterance?
Yeah. It came to pass, not because of what Jotham said, but it came to pass exactly the way he said it would come to pass. And I have to believe that was God working.
Yeah, God inspired. Yeah. All right. Any other thoughts on Abimelech? He's not anybody you want to invite over to dinner. Okay? Or your daughter or marrying. So chapter 10. And chapter 10 actually starts with two minor judges because there's not a whole lot said about them. It says, after Abimelech that rose to save Israel, Tola, the son of Pua, the son of Dodo. Wow. A man of the tribe of what? Issachar. And he dwelt in Shamar in the mountains of Ephraim. So, again, we're close to... we should be pretty close to the same... We would be a little bit north of where we've been. I'm trying to find... It's not on that picture there. I don't even have my picture that I gave you guys.
Shechem is here, and where are we going now?
We're back. We're in Ephraim.
Just south, and not that far south, but just
Shamir.
From Shechem, just south, straight south. Ephraim covered that next section.
Okay. All right, and which would include Shiloh.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So, he judged Israel 23 years, and he died and was buried in Shamir.
Now, why doesn't the author... You said he's a minor judge, but he was there 23 years. I don't figure that to be too minor.
Well, yeah, but for some reason we have nothing...
No details
yeah.
on what he did.
And minor, I would say minor, what I mean minor, in the same way we talk about the minor prophets. Not that what they did was unimportant. It's just we just don't have... We just don't have a lot of information about him.
Yeah, it's funny. We're not told who he went against. He arose to save Israel.
Yeah. Now, what we do know that is beginning to happen at this time historically is the Philistines are growing in power. But the and this what was just described right here, where over here is where you have Gaza, and this region over here is a traditional region of the Philistines. And they would actually come all the way over to border Bethlehem and Jerusalem, and that's just south of the area we just talking about stuff. So it seems like what we're doing in the Judges also is moving southward.
Mm-hmm.
And the prominence of where God is going to be working seems to be moving south on us too. Okay. All right, so then we have the next one. We have the next judge. It said, after him arose Jair, a Gileadite. So where's Gilead? Okay. What are you familiar with when it comes to Gilead? You ever heard the bomb of Gilead? What area is that? Gilead, I believe, is the area over here. You remember the 2.5 tribes that did not cross over to the Jordan River? And the area that's to the east of the Jordan River? The tribes that did not cross over? Gilead's in this area right here.
Yeah, they were part of Gad, right?
Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so if he would have been one of probably part of one of those one of those tribes from that region, one of those 2.5 tribes that remember. Do y'all remember that story? They got to Jericho and were about to go into the land under Joshua, and the 2.5 tribes thought, you know, we like this land over here. Can we stay here? And Joshua sought the Lord, and the Lord said yes, but they have to send their men first in to go with all the other tribes, clean out Canaan, and once that's done, once you're established, then they can go back. So they left their women, probably their older men, their younger men that were not of fighting age and stuff, and they went over, they helped the other Israelites gain the land, and then they came back. Okay. Interesting story there. When they came back, right before they were about to cross back over, they built an altar. Okay, but the altar was an altar of remembrance. It was not an altar of a different sacrifice. But the other tribes thought that they had actually built an altar to a false god, and they came down to kill them. So you're going to have this big fight with the Israeli armies and their own brothers and stuff. And when they got there, they finally said, "No, that's not why we built the altar. We're not worshiping other gods."
But, is that the altar they built when the Lord separated? So they did an altar there. Is that the one? I get confused.
No, that's another altar. Yeah.
There's so many.
Yeah, there are quite a lot of altars. So, anyways, he's a Gileadite, which tells us what region he came from. And he judged Israel 22 years. Now he had 30 sons who rode on 30 donkeys. This 30 donkey thing. You know, we'd almost think that'd be comical, but when you read some of the history and stuff, to ride on donkeys was something special.
Very wealthy.
Very wealthy, yeah. It was a mark of a wealthy person.
Well, they didn't have horses?
I'm sure they had some horses. I'm not, you know. I don't know. That's one of those things that I
signify.
It always the royalty the as Doug says that in those days the kings and the princes they rode on donkeys, not on the horses. So they also had 30 towns which are called Havat Jar, which means the community of Jar, the region of Jar, if you will, to this day, and are in the land of Gilead. And Jar died and was buried in Kamon. Okay, then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served Baals and Ashtaroth, the gods of Syria, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the people of Ammon, the gods of the Philistines, and they forsook the Lord and did not serve him. Why do you suppose, before we move on, that the author here, let's suppose it's Samuel. I'll go along with that. Why do you think that he took so much care in verse 6 to list these people and their gods? Anybody?
No, but my question is, why are they the chosen people?
And my answer always is, because God chose them. Not because of performance, for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, but I want to tell you, I believe these are listed here because it is a reminder to these people that they did not do what God told them to do. And that the result of them not doing what God told them to do would be the exact result that God said would happen. He says, if you do not drive them out, you will begin to serve their gods. Not us, God. We'll always trust you. We'll always love you. Doesn't matter who's around us. You know, and we need to remember that, you know, if you continually hang around with bad company, you're gonna become like that company.
That's almost what's happening today.
Yeah.
That, you know, we were a Christian nation and we keep bringing in people that shouldn't be here.
Yeah. It's interesting. All right, so verse 7. So the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he sold them in the hands of the Philistines and in the hands of Ammon.
That's a pretty big territory.
Very big territory. Ammon today, what we'd call it, Ammon today, would be this a lot of this region over here. Some people say that the Jordanians are the descendants of the Ammonites. I don't know, but that's what they say. And if you anybody know what the capital city of Jordan is? It's Amman. It's Amman, Jordan. Okay, so the Ammonites are, you know, today you have the Ammonites that are represented by the Jordanian. One of the reasons that they say that they call what we call Israel today, what we call Israel, some still call Palestine. Okay, which has been by the British a derogatory term that was done, I think, you know, right after 1900 or something like that, and someone had talked about how what was the one term that could be, you know, the worst for them, and associate with the Philistines, so they called it Palestine. Okay, and then eventually, when Israel was allowed to become a state in 1948. Now it's called Israel, but you'll notice that you still have this big conflict. Some people call it Israel, some people call it Palestine. There are no such ethnic group as a Palestinians. There is no ethnic group called a Palestinian. The Palestinians are a political group. They are not an ethnic group.
Don't say that to anybody.
I know. Depending on where you're standing, you have to be careful. But that the reality is most of the group that we know as the Palestinians were thrown out of Jordan and thrown out of Saudi Arabia. You have Jordan here today, Saudi Arabia down here, and they were ne'er-do-wells that the crowns, the two crowns, the Jordanian crown and the Saudi Arabian crown, these are people we don't want. So what are we going to do? Well, let's force them into this region over here. And now they are called Palestinians. But there's no such thing as an ethnic Palestinian. It is a political term. It is not an ethnic term.
But they've rewritten their own history.
Oh, yes, of course.
Where people do now actually believe that there was a Palestinian nation and that the Palestinian people are being persecuted by the Jews, you know, and that they have rightful inheritance to the land and all of a sudden they have actually rewritten this.
Yes, they have. Yes, they have.
So they were related to the Philistines, you're saying?
No, the term that's used was a derogatory. This region was actually under the control of the British Crown, like so much of the world, you know, and when they were going to turn it back over, it was actually the British that first called it. The British command, I can't remember his name. I've studied the history, but I can't remember his name. He's the first one that called this region Palestine, and it's not that old. I mean, we're talking less than 150 years ago, but they act like it's all the way back to Abraham. But the term Palestine is a relatively new term. It's not an old term, huh?
So many people don't know that.
Of course you don't, because as Doug says, it has been rewritten, and there is a political reason to write it. And it's like anything. Once you say it enough, everybody believes it. And here's the other thing we got to learn from that, Candace. I think we really are only one generation away from people not knowing what really happened in the past. There are those who are pushing it. I wonder how much, if you think about this, how much are kids getting? Be interested if you could ask Jared this. How much actual history concerning World War II is Jared getting?
I don't think very much.
So what is a huge thing that happened in World War II? You have the Axis of Evil, right? You have the Japanese and you have the Germans. And who, you know, the Germans led by Hitler. But if our kids aren't being taught about Nazism and about the attempt to annihilate a whole race of people, genocide, okay, most kids today, even get a little closer, they have no idea what Vietnam is. And you try to tell them to point it out on a map, there's no way possible they can do that. Or were we in a war in Vietnam? Was there a World War II? Was there really a man named Hitler? Oh, he really didn't do everything y'all said he did. That's kind of just exaggerated for the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
It's propaganda.
Yeah.
That's where we are. And what I'm saying is, it doesn't take long for history to just be completely true history to be set aside, and you have a creation of history that's not true. So anyways, here again, we get there and we talk about that these are the people that God said, you drive them out. If you don't, you will eventually serve their gods. Now, the writer here tells us that's exactly what they're... And by the way, these people are people... Sidon, if you think about it, Sidon is all the way up here. The Philistines are all the way over here. And Ammon is all the way over here. So what's he saying? In all the region, in all the area that God has given them for Israel, including the area on the east side of the Jordan River, where Gilead and the 2.5 tribes, he's saying to them, "You've turned away. Pretty much, there's no faith in Israel." Wow. So Israel has done exactly what the U.S. has done. We were a nation built upon biblical truth, indisputable, historic. We weren't a nation built upon religion. We were a nation built upon eternal truth. And we understand there's two different things. In the same way that Israel was to be a theocracy, a nation built upon God. And it wasn't too long till, as he describes here, the entirety of the nation has gone away from God. Now, does that mean that every individual? Of course not, because God always has a remnant. It's the same way it is in our country today. Our country is a post-Christian nation. We're past that time. If you think about it, every other theological system and ism is welcome here, except for biblical Christianity. Whoever thought that would happen? So we are a post-Christian nation, but God still has his remnant. Okay? History repeats itself over and over and over again. All right, so verse 7. So the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel. He sold them into the hands of the Philistines and the hands of people of Ammon. From that year, they harassed and oppressed the children of Israel for 18 years. All the children of Israel who were on the other side of the Jordan in the land of the Amorites in Gilead. And that's this area right here I just showed you. Gad, Gadara. Okay, that's the Gileadites. And that's the side, that's where the Ammonites' main area is. Okay. And the children of Israel cried out to the Lord, saying,
"Verse 9.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, so I'm sorry. Moreover, the people of Ammon crossed over the Jordan to fight against Judah, also against Benjamin and against the house of Ephraim, so that Israel was severely distressed." So, look at what's happening. They're being pinched off. Okay, Philistines here, Ammonites here, Ephraim. The area of Ephraim's right here above Jerusalem. And then he draws a picture here of the people of Judah. Judah is this region right here, southern region, which also includes Bethlehem. Now, what's interesting is for the Jews at this time, Bethlehem was more significant to them than Jerusalem. Okay? Now, as a matter of fact, it really wasn't called Jerusalem at this time. It was called Jebu, where the Jebusites lived. Mm-hmm. And eventually became Jerusalem. So just so you know, geographically, you have Bethlehem right here. You have Jerusalem right here. The old city of Bethlehem and the old city of Jerusalem, that's what we're dealing with. They're 5 miles apart. That's the distance. They're not. Matter of fact, today, the modern cities of Bethlehem and Jerusalem, they're connected. They're like Phoenix and Mesa. It's all connected. There's no time that you leave the city to go from Jerusalem to Bethlehem. Except Bethlehem is in the Palestinian area. So there is like a 25-foot solid concrete wall that runs the whole thing. And you have to go through the guards, and you have to go through. You have to switch buses from an Israeli bus to a Palestinian bus before you can go into Bethlehem. It's almost freaky when you do that, too. But all right, so verse 10. And the children, you know what? I'm not going to go on. We'll start verse 10 next week. Chapter 10, verse 10. Be an easy place to start. But once again, we